start the next session. The speaker is Greiser, from Oldenburg, and he'll be talking about spectral asymptotics for fat graphs. And he'll be using the blackboard, so there's a request that if you all could just move up a little bit so that he doesn't have to write very big letters.
Well, if you're interested, if you want to work, you can sit wherever you want. Well, first, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to present my work here in this regard. I should say that I'm not sort of really an expert in this whole metric graphs business. And so I'm actually very happy to learn some of these things in this workshop. But of course, it also means that I may not know the literature so well. So if you notice that I'm obviously leaving something out or not knowing something, then please tell me through the talk or afterwards. So what is the thing that I'm going to talk about? So let me say it in words first, and then start with the details. So you take a graph embedded in Rn. You take an epsilon neighborhood. You let epsilon go to zero, and you ask about the asymptotic behavior of the eigenvalues of the Laplacian. And of course, you have to impose boundary conditions. And the case of Neumann boundary conditions has been well known for quite some time. I'll say a little more about this later. And there was always this problem about other boundary conditions, for example, Dirichlet. And so I will propose a solution for this problem. So what's the setting? So G will always be a finite metric graph. So metric, so you have a finite number of vertices and edges. And metric means you have edge lengths. And little e will always be edges. And LE will be the half edge length. Now, this may sound funny to you. Yeah? So the edge E will have the length 2 times LE. You'll see shortly. I find this more convenient, actually, to denote by LE the full edge length. So what kind of data are we given? So I said I take an epsilon neighborhood, but I'll consider this slightly more general setup where you model a manifold on this thing. So what does that mean? You fix some integer n, and you take an n-dimensional manifold xv for each vertex. V is always a vertex. And you take an n minus 1 dimensional manifold ye for each edge. And you think of the YEs as cross sections of the cylinders that you put on the edges, and XV are the neighborhoods of the vertices. And if you put in this abstract framework, I should say what kind of manifolds there are. They're always Riemannian manifolds. So you have a notion of length, compact, and possibly with a boundary, and of course that's the interesting case here. And piecewise smooth boundary, I write. I don't want to spend any time on this. It's just sufficient regularity so that you have the basics of compact resolving for the Laplacian and so on. So what additional data do you need? So you need some way of gluing these edges with cross section YE to the vertex neighborhoods. So I need gluing maps YE into the boundary of XV. So this is for all, let me make this a sort of a sketch, for all edges which are incident to a vertex. And then I also fix subsets D and N, so this will correspond to Dirichlet-Neumann boundary conditions of these boundaries. All right. And then out of this, I'll construct this sort of epsilon neighborhood of the graph, G epsilon, I'll call it. So this is just the union of the XV over all vertices with the cylinders over the edges with cross sections YE, and I said the edge length is 2 times LE. So I put 2 times LE here. And I guess I want to make things small, so I put a scaling factor epsilon in front of the vertex neighborhood and also in front of the cross sections. And then this is, of course, then I glue. So I just say modulo gluing, these gluing maps. And then, this gives me a Laplacian. So because everything is a Riemannian manifold, I have a Laplace operator. Yeah?
This epsilon y is very small, so how you glue it to?
I glue it to epsilon x.
Ah, to epsilon x?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I scale the vertices and the.
Can you make a picture?
Right, so yeah, I'll make a picture. I'll make a picture here. Well, let me make the picture here. So let's say my graph is just a triangle graph. Let's say my yes are just intervals, so they are sort of like this. So these are the cylinders over each edge, and so they have a width of epsilon if I take unit intervals. And then I have this vertex neighborhood. These are sort of these things. Okay, so the red, yeah. So everything is scaled by epsilon, yes?
LS is independent of epsilon.
Right. I know, the two problems do not coincide precisely, but there's a trivial... I say L should be independent of epsilon. One could arrange it. Yes?
In your picture, the vertex neighborhoods and the edge neighborhoods have the same dimension. Above you said...
Yes, they do. But the cross sections of the edges have one dimension less.
Cross section.
So YE is a cross section, and I put the cylinder over the cross section. Yeah? So this is the case n equal to 2. Okay, so then I mean, having these subsets D and N of the boundaries gives me, subsets D and N of this G epsilon. And what is important here, of course, is that along each edge, I have a product structure. So for example, I could have, I could have sort of Dirichlet here and Neumann on this side, but then I should have it along the whole edge. Yeah, so the thing should not change along the edge. Dn, it could change to Dirichlet here, whatever. So I get a Laplace operator, and so... I'm interested in the behavior, as I said, of the eigenvalues as epsilon goes to 0. Now, an essential object here is the following number, nu. I want to put it here so I can keep it for the rest of the talk. So nu is supposed just to be the smallest eigenvalue of the Laplacians on the cross sections. So let me just call this lambda 1 of the Laplacian on the cross section and the smallest one over each edge. So this is sort of essential. So this is the fundamental mode, if you want, the fundamental frequency in the cross sectional direction. And of course, you would expect that this plays a role in the problem. So here's sort of. One version of the theorem that I'm going to prove. So let lambda k of epsilon be the kth eigenvalue of, I'll just say of g epsilon, yeah, Laplacian on g epsilon. So the theorem is there exist numbers, d, non-negative integer, and tau 1, tau 2, tau d between 0 and nu, and then a sequence of numbers going to infinity, so that the following holds, that you have, so that for each k, you have the following asymptotics of the kth eigenvalue. So if k is small, so if k is between 1 and d, then, so k is a natural number, then you have epsilon minus 2 tau k, and then plus an error, which is actually exponentially small. And the higher up eigenvalues are of the same form, except the leading term is always nu, and then the subleading term is bk. I guess I should shift this so it makes sense. I'm going to start from 1. And then you have a small error, which is not quite as small. This is the asymptotic behavior of the eigenvalues.
So do you assume that mu is non-negative or
I assume that it's not negative. I guess in under these assumptions, because I look at Laplacian on a, it's a neg- it could be zero.
It could be zero.
Yeah, it could be zero. Yeah. Right. So so let me make some comments on this. So maybe to pick up that comment first. So in the Neumann case, so when the Dirichlet boundary is empty beyond the Neumann case, then of course nu is zero, and then d is also zero. It's quite easy to see. So you only have this second line here, and it's known. So the bk are the so-called Kirchhoff eigenvalues of the graph, of the metric graph G. Well, I guess at some point I should quote at least the people who are here, as usual, the usual game. So in various degrees of generality, so this was done by Kutschm and Cheng, Rubinstein, Schatzmann, who are not here, but all right, anyway. And Colin de Verdier also used some related thing at some point. And then, of course, I should mention Exner and Post. As I say, various degrees of generality, embedded domains or this thing with manifolds, and Exner and Post did a different scaling of vertices and edges and all kinds of details. I guess I forgot side to. I don't know. Maybe I forgot anybody else. So this is what I know. All right. So this is the theorem. Before I go on, let me just mention a few things. I have stated it in a sort of rough way, and there are various refinements that I can do. I just want to mention them shortly, and then, you know, if you want to read about them, the paper is almost ready. You actually have full asymptotics up to exponentially small error terms. So whenever I say exponentially small, I mean e to the minus the constant over epsilon, where the constant is positive. So also in this case, so you can actually determine what all the other terms are, and the asymptotics is in fact convergent. This comes from the analyticity.
I guess you will say what are the
tokens
and the.
Yeah, no, of course. Okay. No, this is a very important point. So I'll come to that. So besides the asymptotics of eigenvalues, I can also give asymptotics of eigenfunctions. In the easiest case in L2, but also in higher norms if you have sufficient boundary regularity, of course, otherwise it wouldn't help very much. This is, for example, useful if you're interested in nodal line questions. So there's a paper by myself and David Jarrison also, where we answer some questions in that business using some things like this. The other thing is, I stated the theorem when k is fixed and epsilon goes to infinity, but in fact, you get more than this. You get uniform asymptotics. I guess for k less than a constant divided by epsilon. So k is allowed to go to infinity with epsilon as long as it's not too far. I'll explain maybe a little bit of this later.
Can I stop you for a second?
Yes.
Just to ask again. So in this theorem, you have arbitrary boundary conditions on the edges and on this manifold x.
Yes.
And you still have the second term of the asymptotics in the second formula.
Yes.
You have the same eigenvalues that come from the Kirchhoff.
No. No. This is only in this case here.
Oh, all right. Okay.
It will be. I'll address this question. What is it in other cases?
Okay.
Yeah. It's a tricky question. And all right, so what are the aims of the talk? I would like to at least give some idea of the proof. It should involve answers to these questions. What are these coefficients? How do we compute them? And this answer, and this question will be answered first in terms of scattering data, but not on a graph, but on an n-dimensional problem. So sort of PDE scattering data, not ODE scattering data, if you want. And then, of course, the big question is, so when can the scattering data be sort of evaluated in terms of the graph? Discussion of scattering data. And we'll see that an essential difference to the Neumann case is that there's a great degree of instability here, which leads me to claim that in some sense it's a stupid problem. I mean, it's probably not sort of the right problem one should look at, but rather one should actually look at some different problems. So change the problem.
Before the proof or after?
Which I haven't done yet, of course, but I'll just give some idea what I'm thinking of. All right. So. Any other questions about the claim and the setting? Yes.
What do you get for Dirichlet conditions?
Okay, so let me say it shortly right now. It depends. I claim that for almost all geometric data, so let me call these x's and the y's geometric data. Yeah, this is the geometric data. So for almost all geometric data, you get decoupled. You get the bk are the graph eigenvalues of the decoupled problem where at each edge you put Dirichlet boundary conditions. There are exceptions.
And this is why you have to change the problem, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's an unstable. It's instability is what I said here. So then you perturb it just arbitrarily little, the y's and the x's, and it will go away. Yeah. Okay, any other questions? So it will be very important, not just convenient, but really important to understand the whole thing, to rescale the problem. So I said I'm looking at this thing which shrinks to the graph. But what I want to do is I want to multiply the whole thing, I mean all lengths, by a factor of 1 over epsilon. So let me call capital N is 1 over epsilon. And the thing that I obtain, for some reason I call x and g. doesn't matter. So I multiply all lengths by epsilon minus 1. It's my notation. So what happens? You look at the same picture, but now the widths of the channels are constant, but the channels get longer. So essentially, what you have is the following. You have things like this. So I'm going to try to use the same color coding here. And then you have the cylindrical part. You have this for every vertex D, and then edge coming out of it. And okay, so you have various of these things. I will not draw the colors in the other cases. It takes me too long. For this, I should have made slides, I guess. So what am I doing here? I'm just redrawing this triangle example in a different way. But now these green things are just the half edges, is what I mentioned in the beginning. How do I get the triangle back from this? Is by doing a certain gluings. Yeah, so I sort of glue this to this, and this to this, and this to this. And then I get the rescaled triangle. Now here the cross sections, of course, these cross sections here are just YE, and the length of these cylinders is LE times N because of the rescalings. So they go to infinity as N goes to infinity. And because they're the half edges, there's no factor of 2 here. Yes?
Just for clarity, you can have more than 2 edges joining.
Oh, yeah, sure. The degree is any finite graph. You can also have loops and multiple edges and everything. Yeah.
Is this a graph supposed to be, it's only locally embedded in R, some RN?
I don't care about embedding.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, embedding doesn't make a difference. Okay. So I will call Xn exactly these things, but without the gluing. So sort of it's the union over all the vertices of, let me just call them vertex neighborhoods with cylinders. Yeah. Exactly the picture that I drew here, except that I do not glue the right end here to the right end here. So it's just a disjoint union. Well, let me write disjoint union here. So then an essential object for the analysis will be just the eigenspace, the transversal eigenspace for nu. In order to formulate this, I should say W is the total cross section. So it's just the union of all the YEs, actually sort of 2 times, because every edge appears twice as a half edge. Then I have V is just the kernel, or I mean the eigenspace. How do you say this? The kernel of the Laplacian on Y at the eigenvalue nu or minus nu. Now, of course, this looks complicated. I mean, V is sort of a big vector space. It has a contribution from each one of these half edges. So it's just a direct sum of the edge pieces. I should say it's a direct sum over the half edges. So let me call half edges by E tilde or E bar. Yeah. So each edge gives 2 half edges, and the half edge I call E bar. And then this would also be a union of the Y E bar. And V E bar is just the ground state, standby the ground state on each edge, unless the eigenvalue on that cross section of that edge is actually bigger than nu, then it would be 0. Because I have to formulate things in terms of linear algebra on this space V. So V is a finite dimensional subspace, of course. This is a compact thing. Y is compact. So I somehow need to encode things in terms of linear maps. And one thing that I have to encode is the graph structure. And that's just a linear map, sigma. And it's exactly this sort of this gluing. It's just an involution. So sigma square is the identity. So what sigma does, it sort of identifies functions on here with functions on the cross-section that I glue with. So that's the graph structure. And the lengths are also encoded in some linear map, which is just a diagonal map with respect to this splitting of into edges. So I need these things in order to state the result precisely in just a minute. Okay, I still have my blackboard. So what else? Right. So in order to state the result, I need to introduce a little bit more of notation, but I'm almost done. Okay. So let's think about the problem again. We let epsilon go to zero, so this corresponds to n going to infinity, and so the limit problem here is when n is equal to infinity, so it's this non-compact thing. So x infinity is, I mean, Michael Levitin talked about this, is a manifold with cylindrical ends. So you just have these infinite cylinders here. And so you have, of course, absolutely continuous spectrum of the Laplacian on this thing. And it's, of course, quite well known that you have that it starts at nu, the smallest cross-sectional eigenvalue. So you have a number of extra data here, which I'll need. So for one, there's the scattering matrix. S of alpha. So let me here introduce a notation. My eigenvalue will usually be lambda. And if I'm looking at the essential spectrum, so lambda is bigger than or equal to nu, then I write lambda as nu plus alpha squared. And I'll use alpha as the parameter, which is natural because the scattering matrix is holomorphic in alpha, but not in lambda, at least near zero. Okay, so this is, again, a linear map from V to V, depending holomorphically on alpha, for alpha near zero. And it's unitary. And there are all kinds of properties for each alpha. It's unitary. And one important property that I'll need is that S of 0 is an involution. So the square of S of 0 is the identity. Now, what does it mean to be an involution? Being an involution means you just have plus and minus 1 eigenspaces. Because it's unitary, it's actually self-adjoint. So you have plus and minus 1 eigenspaces. I call them V plus and minus 1. V plus minus. So V plus minus 1 eigenspaces. And they're orthogonal to each other. All right. So this is the first important part of the data which I'll need. In many cases, I guess, I have eigenvalues on x infinity, which are below the essential spectrum. So these are L2 eigenvalues on the non-compact thing. And I write tau I because these tau I will be the ones mentioned in the theorem up here. I guess I should call them tau k to keep the notation. And then I have a certain number of tau k equal to nu, I don't know. There's something, I'm not going into this. There's always special considerations about the threshold, so about the eigenvalue nu. And this is what you get. You need to take that nu exactly this many times, plus one eigenspace, and the plus one eigenspace of this involution sigma, which encodes the graph structure. All right. So I'm almost done, and I'll restate the theorem in terms of this data, and so we'll be also more precise then. I'll do this right now.
Is it clear that you have no embedded eigenvalues?
Good point. No. Of course, there can be embedded eigenvalues, and I'll just keep away from them. I will assume in the theorem to state that nu is not an eigenvalue. Of course, nu itself could also be an eigenvalue, the threshold. Of course, very unstably, but it could be. For technical reasons, I assume it's not, but I actually don't think it's needed. It's just, it has to work a little harder. So in a sense, I will always stick in the range of sort of energies on X infinity, which is below the embedded eigenvalues, and also which is below the second cross-sectional eigenvalue. So I'm always sort of working near the first threshold. Okay. So what's the theorem? Is that all right? So the eigenvalues on X and G are of the form lambda nu plus alpha squared, or what I'll call it alpha, I n squared. And what are these alpha I n's? So the alpha I n's are obtained as follows. Alpha I n are zeros of this following function. It's a certain determinant, which has to vanish, e to the I alpha n times 2L times sigma times S of alpha. So this is, let's see, this is not, this is correct. Right. So, But this is not the main thing that I'll use. I will sort of a reduced version of this. So we have actually that alpha I n, so that's also another statement, is of the following form, is 1 over n times the function a k of a n, where a k is holomorphic. And this fact is the complete asymptotics, this convergence. AK, so the leading term here is AK of 0, are the zeros of the following function. Let me give it a name, maybe F of A, determinant of identity minus e to the IA2L sigma S of 0. Okay, let's have a look at this.
There's L, I'm lost a bit.
Right, I was just going to explain, yeah. So what kind of data does appear here? So there's L and there's sigma. L and sigma are given by the graph. So sigma is sort of the how the edges are connected to each other, and L is just the edge length, the matrix of edge length. Now S of 0 is the scattering matrix at the threshold, so at alpha equals 0, which corresponds to energy nu.
Why is the edge length a function from B into V?
Well, I make it such. I mean, V is the direct sum over the edges, and I make it just multiplication by edge length of E on the piece corresponding to E.
It's just
diagonal. Yeah, so that's all.
Okay. So yes. It's those eigenvalues which are larger than nu. There are others.
Oh, yeah, of course. Thank you.
Plus the others.
So let me say in nu, comma, nu plus epsilon. Yeah, thanks. Not epsilon. Epsilon was different. Delta. Okay. Thanks.
Alpha n.
And of, sorry?
Left in the formula, the second line from the bottom. The second one. No, this is the third.
This?
K on the right hand side. What is on the left hand side?
Alpha I n.
Right.
Yes. Is equal to 1 over n times a k of 1 over n.
Yes,
but what is k and I?
What is yeah.
Oops. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. This is k. Sorry. Thank you. Yeah.
What else?
So the statement is true for I equal k.
Yes. Yeah. That might be a generalization. In any case, So this is really what we will be concerned with sort of in the end. And this will sort of lead to the special case. So why is AK of 0 important? Because it's the leading term in this asymptotics here, 1 over n. And you see, it will give nu plus AK of 0. So this is, of course, then nu plus AK of 0 squared divided by n squared, which is exactly the same as what's written here. And then plus smaller order term. So what this says is that the BKs in this theorem, or maybe up to a shift, I don't know, are exactly the same as the AKs in this at zero in this theorem squared. Yeah. So this is the connection of the two. And you also see that sort of the higher order things are sort of derivatives of scattering data. So, all right. So these are the eigenvalues. Now, what about the eigenvalues? These first things with the tau k. Now, of course, they come from the L2 eigenvalues on the infinite problem. I think I'm not going to write this. So they're exactly these tau i's. I have to select. First I have to erase. So let me sketch the proof, or just a few steps in the proof. Okay. So this is in a sense a sort of low-tech proof. I'm not using the resolvent, for example. I'm just trying to argue with as little sort of machinery as possible, and I'm just using this scattering data. I'm sort of assuming that, of course, it's nowhere known, the scattering theory. I'm not using anything beyond it. I'm saying this because there are related works by sort of a totally different culture of mathematics. For example, a paper by Hasse, Mazzio, and Melrose, where they are interested in global analysis invariants, like the eta invariant, which is also determined by the spectrum, and how that behaves under exactly the same kind of limit. And in order to obtain this, they actually make a very, very precise analysis of the uniform behavior of the resolvent as a function of n on this full space. And in a sense, all these things would come out of their papers if one would read these papers very precisely. Of course, they don't allow boundary conditions, but that really doesn't make much of a difference, I claim. But it's really high-tech, and it's... not easy to understand. So this will actually be a very direct approach, which also very, very quickly shows how this formula comes about. Let me try to explain a little bit. So the proof will consist of two steps. First, you construct eigenfunctions. Of course, only you cannot construct them precisely. You sort of only construct approximate eigenfunctions from the data on X infinity. So what is that data? That's the scattering matrix and these eigenfunctions on X infinity. And then you need to show that you got them all. Right? That every eigenvalue on Xn for finite n is obtained in the way by this construction. On every eigenfunction, because I'm also making claims about the functions and the multiplicities and everything. The first step is, let me shortly indicate how this works for small eigenvalues, meaning below the threshold, because then it's really very easy. And so this gives an sort of idea of the very basic principle. So let's say you take U, it's an eigenfunction on the X infinity. And then because lambda is less than the threshold, U is actually exponentially decreasing as x goes to infinity. So little x will be always a coordinate in the cylindrical direction, so it goes to infinity. So that's just separation of variables on the cylindrical part. And so what you can do, I want to concoct an approximate eigenfunction on xn for finite n from this. So what do I do? I just cut it off. Chi n times u, where chi n is just a cutoff function, which is 1. So 1, and then between n minus 1 and 1, n, it goes to 0. So I take that function and just make it artificially equal to 0 near x equal to n, which then implies that I can consider it as a function on that glued graph. Because I have no matching conditions here to satisfy. They're automatically satisfied because the function is 0 in the neighborhood of x equals to n. And then you just plug this in. And you see, of course, because u is an exact eigenfunction, that you only get derivatives term of chi. Because the derivative of chi is supported where x is roughly n, and because then u is very small at this place, this is very small compared to the L2 norm of u, or of u tilde, if you want, then it's just a sort of trivial spectral approximation lemma to show that there is an eigenvalue of the xn problem, which is this, which is exponentially close to this lambda. OK, so this is the case lambda less than nu. And for this, this was the first step, to constructing eigenfunctions. And to show that you get them all, in this case, is actually exactly the same. You do it the opposite way. Because an eigenfunction on xn, when n is very large, you imagine you have this very long edge, and you have an eigenfunction, and it's sort of bounded at the ends. And the eigenvalue is less than the cross-section. It's sort of like a cosine hyperbolicus. It's very small in the middle. And so you have the same thing. Because you can both ways, can go both ways, basically by the same reasoning, turning it around, you easily see that you got them all in this way. Now, the much harder part, of course, is the continuous spectrum. Because, for both steps, it's harder. Now, of course, here this exponential decay is not true anymore. But what is true, of course, that every function, so u eigenfunction, if you have a eigenfunction equation where lambda is nu plus alpha squared, then you always have a sort of leading part. And then you have something which is exponentially decaying, where these phis and psis are the sort of the part of the eigenfunction which transversally is in the basic mode in the lowest frequency, and so this is sort of the leading term which I call pi u, and this I call pi per u. So if this is an eigenfunction, let's say on xn, So the thing is that now, of course, the second part is decaying, but the first part is not. So I cannot just simply cut off u. So what do I want to do? I want to use, of course, here I wanted to use the scattering data to construct eigenfunctions. What is the scattering data in this case? It's the generalized eigenfunctions. So there's sort of the main. I didn't explain what the scattering matrix is. I'll do it now. The scattering matrix is defined as follows. That on the infinite thing, so on the manifold with cylindrical infinite cylindrical ends, I have these solutions of the eigenfunction equation, whose leading part, they have to be of this form. And the statement is for each phi, there's a unique psi, so that this is true. And that unique psi is then called S of alpha times phi, and that's the definition of the scattering matrix. Plus phi curve. And, right, so this is the statement. And now what I want to do, I want to construct the approximate eigenfunction from this. Well, I did a cutoff, and of course I should not cut off this thing because it doesn't decay, so am I introducing errors which are too big? So what I should do, I should rather, well, this is pi u, pi e, I should just cut off this small part. So this is what I'm going to do. And then I do the same reasoning as before. I only have a little bit of a problem because, well, this is zero near this right end where I have to match the function at this place and at this place. But the first part is not zero there. So I get a condition on alpha and phi so that this thing, you know, sort of glues together as a function on x and g. Yeah? So originally, this is a function on the infinite cylinder. I restrict it to x being less than n, and now I have to make sure that at x equal to n, the boundary values match whenever the edge is glued to the other, one half edge is glued to the other half edge. And this is exactly, well, if you just a trivial calculation gives this. All right, maybe.
What's the norm of E
theta? Oh, well, no, of course. I mean, E is not in L2. Therefore, it's a generalized eigenfunction because this part doesn't decay. It's just oscillating. But in a sense, it's a linear map from phi's into
C's. You just make superposition. You make superposition. It depends. Yeah. S depends on alpha. That makes it work.
Oh, yeah, if you want to, the spectral subspace, yeah, you make a superposition and then it becomes L2, of course, yeah. Well, I think in order not to go over time, I should, well, I don't know. What part are you more interested in? The existence part of, I mean, the part two in this case, I think I should actually say something about the question, what are these BKs? I think this is more essential at this point. So I'll stop with a sketch of the proof of all this. And so now what I have to do is, well, I'll actually leave this. I want to discuss the theorem now a little bit in terms of the question of what are these coefficients? So what are these AK of zeros is what the question is. And how can they, or are they determined by the graph? Or if not, how are they determined? And this is, you know, this is really the information that you need because that's the defining equation. It involves graph data plus S of zero. So it should be determined in terms of graph data, but in addition, you have this S of zero. So what is S of zero? Of course, saying what S of zero is the same as saying what V plus is, let us say. So meaning of S of zero, I mean, this characterization was only true when alpha is non-zero. So I have to say what it's when alpha is equal to zero. Let me see if I get it right. I don't get it wrong here now. Scattering solutions. Let's say the V minus space here. So giving S of zero is the same as V plus minus. So if I have this of the form X times V minus and scattering solutions, this is always as X goes to infinity. Right, so At the threshold, you don't have oscillating behavior of the leading part, but you have either constancy when x goes to infinity, which is the second line, or you have linear increase. You know, it's a trivial ODE calculation. And the V minus corresponds exactly to the coefficients that you have from the in the leading in the linearly increasing case, and this you have in the other case. And when you do rescaling, you push everything down to the original setting, then what you see is that if V plus is 0, which means that V minus is everything, which means that every of these generalized eigenfunctions has this behavior, then we get Dirichlet conditions on the original graph. I mean, that these BKs, this is, I'm addressing your question now, that this these BKs are come from Dirichlet conditions on the graph. Also, you can characterize what Kirchhoff conditions means. You know, it's just simple translation with this equation, so I cannot do it. So this would mean that V minus is actually, V plus is not zero, but it's just one-dimensional and spanned by the vector, by constant vector. So in order, for example, to obtain an X and post result, you have to show that V plus is equal to this in the case of Neumann boundary conditions. That's not very difficult. And now, sort of in the last few minutes, I would like to explain why I think that generically V plus is actually zero. So, which means that generically, you know, for generic geometric data, you have you have a decoupling on the graph. Well, maybe to explain this shortly, let me just give the simple example, because everybody knows that if you take the doubly infinite strip with the Dirichlet boundary conditions, then the scattering matrix, you have the generalized eigenfunction, let's say sine y, this is the y direction, this is the x direction, and x times sine y. So you have one which is linearly increasing and one which is not. So which means for this strip, in fact, V plus and V minus are non-zero. So in the light of my claim, this should be highly non-generic. And you know that it's highly non-generic. As soon as you dent it in just any tiny little bit, then you have no bounded solutions anymore. Laplace plus nu u equals zero. Like the sine y solution goes away. I mean, this is a very easy proof, like with this Dirichlet to Neumann operator, whatever. So no matter how little you dent it in. And what I claim that, and this is really not proven, it's sort of a heuristic, that although this proof depends, of course, on the fact that I dented in and not out, that the same should be true for almost all claims. Same happens. So no bounded solutions, of course, means exactly what I said in words, that V plus is zero. So Dirichlet on the graph. Clear. Same is true generically. And let me say just in a few words why I think this is true. The truth of this fact can easily be reduced to the non-invertibility of a certain Dirichlet to Neumann operator. So it's very, very similar to what Michael said. Wait a second. No, I claim this is generically true, so I should say it's equivalent to the invertibility. And Now, of course, in the set of all operators, the invertible ones are open and dense. And so you just have to find, you know, one, let's say, which is invertible, and here you have it. And then you would expect, because you consider the Dirichlet-Riemann operator as a function of the domain of that finite part of that, you know, xd here. And so it's clear that you should expect this. And so what does this tell us really in the light of this whole business of trying to find a scaling limit so that the limit eigenvalues give interesting boundary conditions on the metric graph? It tells us that this isn't really a good way of trying. What you should really do what did we do wrong? I said, if I dented in arbitrarily little, I get the limits. So these are the limits as n go to infinity, which are uninteresting. But of course, we are never in the case n is equal to infinity. N is always big but finite. So what one should really do, one should do a joint asymptotics. Let me call this thickness delta. So what one should really do, one should do a joint asymptotics of delta going to 0 and n going to infinity. Of course, coupled in some way so that product is bounded or whatever. Of course, this is a different problem. It would have to be investigated. But if one did this, then one would have a chance to actually obtain sort of interesting ak of zeros, interesting coefficients here, vk, which then may, you know, model something that on the graph itself.
What is delta geometrically? I don't see the
Say
delta.
It again. What is?
Delta. What is delta in your geometry? I mean, in this
delta. Picture, oh, yeah.
Yeah, but what is it when you have a graph?
Yeah. No, this is, yeah, right. This is it's not clear to me at all. I mean, this was an example. This was an example where you were in the non-generic case. Now, I ask you, actually, do you know any other examples?
Examples of what?
Where the scattering matrix at zero is just minus identity.
Well, if you have a virtual level at zero, then the scattering matrix will be...
What's a virtual level? you explain me later. Okay. But, I mean, if you think of the usual things like here, these things which I draw here, so you would have these things, these sort of angles. Do you have a virtual level then?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But if you are in higher dimensions, that you're probably unlikely to have a virtual level.
Yeah, I mean there will be some sort of very special examples that one happens to be able to calculate it. Yeah?
Maybe it's related to your last question about the joint asymptotic, but there was a recent preprint by Olchanov and Weinberg. They essentially looked at one of those pieces with the long pieces without gluing them together.
Yes.
But what they did, they looked, you are only looking at the neighborhood of the first threshold, yeah?
Yes.
You don't go above the second.
Yeah.
And their claim essentially is that if you go higher beyond other thresholds, you do get, in some
no,
sense...
No, they stay, they can stay below the second threshold, but they somehow choose the point in the middle. So if you scale and everything blows up...
It goes away.
So the lower threshold goes down. Yeah, and
but
then
they also claim...
Non-trivial boundary conditions.
Are they look a family of things where the threshold sort of moves with the family?
Somehow they fix the point. Here is the first threshold, second threshold. And they, with respect to these points, they scale. That means that the
first threshold... So it's a point that you don't see.
Yeah.
You're infinity already.
Yes.
But
yes.
They claim that in your regime, they also claim, I'm not sure that they have proven this exactly, but they also claim that it decouples. And Post had a recent paper where there was a particular example where he showed that it decouples.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to mention this. There's, of course, this paper by Post where he says that if the vertex neighborhoods have sort of small first eigenvalue, I mean, or no, bigger than u, then it decouples. And this quite easily follows from this stuff, too. And this is sort of translation of this. Yeah, I should have mentioned that. Yes.
Shall we thank the speaker once, and then we'll...
Yeah,
okay.
Yes. It's... if you look at your equation, determinant of 1 minus of the equation of for the alpha, no, this one.
Yeah.
Are the complex zeros related to the tau case, or because usually you have the scattering matrix and you look at...
This one does. The limiting equation doesn't have complex zeros. I haven't.
If you look at purely imaginary zeros, maybe they are related to the tau case.
To the
eigenvalues which are smaller than you.
Right. No, they are. They are exactly. Yes. Of course. Exactly. That's what they are. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's exactly what they are.
But do you have something like Levinson's theorem also?
What is Levinson's theorem?
it relates the number of bound, in the S matrix theorem, relates the number of bound states to the difference of the phases of the S matrix.
One more question.
Do you have actual examples where, say, mu is positive and you get this Kirchhoff conditions? You say this could happen. But can you really prove that such domain exists? The case when your V plus is one-dimensional on the other board.
Well, in this case, it happens.
No. The case where you have Kirchhoff conditions and you have Dirichlet, you have new strictly positive. You said you mentioned if V plus is one-dimensional. You're just standing in front of it.
That's the Neumann case.
Yeah, it doesn't really exist. You say...
In the Neumann case, it's always like this.
Yeah, Neumann, okay, but not Neumann. If the new is positive, can it really happen? Or is it...
Well, this is here. Well, this is not an embedded thing, of course.
Yeah.
You could, but an abstract thing, you just take an edge and you make it straight.
Okay, but it's a trivial case.
But you cannot embed it in RN.
More than two edges.
Yeah, no, this was my question, which I asked the audience about 5 minutes ago, that I don't.
Can it be more than one-dimensional also? You don't know. That D plus is more than one-dimensional?
Yeah, this is also a question.
Not here, okay.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions? Otherwise,
there are questions, but there are not. There are no answers.
Okay, let's start with the